Welcome to Leading Lives, a podcast from Vanderbilt University. I'm your host, Derek Bruff, Director of the Vanderbilt Center for Teaching. In this podcast, we explore creative, intentional, and effective uses of technology to enhance student learning, uses that point the way to the future of educational technology in college and university settings. I have with me today Gayatri Narasimham, who is the Associate Director of the Vanderbilt Institute for Digital Learning, and she has a really interesting interview for us. The interview follows up on our last episode, which featured three grad students at Vanderbilt who have a podcast on gaming studies, particularly video gaming studies. And today's interview also kind of fits a theme that we've been exploring here on the podcast of faculty who are bringing in technology into their course because of the content of what they're teaching. They're teaching new media. They're teaching digital media. And our guest in this episode does exactly that. Gayatri?
Thank you, Derek. It was really a fun interview to talk with Professor Jay Clayton, who is the William R. Keenan Jr. Professor of English and Director of the Curb Center for Art, Enterprise, and Public Policy at Vanderbilt University. Professor Clayton has published many works, one of which is very famous, is his book on Charles Dickens in Cyberspace, The Afterlife of the 19th Century in Postmodern Culture, published by Oxford University Press in 2003. In my interview with him, I talked to Jay about his experiences teaching his game studies class.
I have to say, I've actually had Jay guest in my cryptography seminar, and it was because of that work around Charles Dickens and kind of 19th century. We look at Charles Babbage and Ada Lovelace, who were kind of instrumental in not only the birth of computing, but in some really interesting ways in cryptography. And I had a really fantastic guest lecture by Jay in my course a couple years ago, where he looked at kind of the role of discipline specialty versus kind of interdisciplinary work and how that's changed over time. He's a really fascinating guy, and I'm happy to share this interview here on the podcast today.
Today, we are talking with Professor Jay Clayton, professor in the English department and the director of the Curb Center at Vanderbilt. Jay uses gaming in his classes. I first met Professor Jay Clayton when I started my job at the Vanderbilt Institute for Digital Learning, and when Jay was instructor, he produced the course on online games, a massive open online course that we are offering through Coursera. Hi, Jay. Thank you for talking with me today. And our listeners would be very excited to hear about your experience with using games. And before I even get into your class with the games, tell us how you became interested in video games and online games.
Well, hello. It's great to see you again. I started becoming interested in gaming in the late 1990s. I was teaching a class on that I called the Culture of Cyberspace, and it was a course about in those days about how to use the web and how digital experience was changing our understanding of textuality in literature classes. And eventually I realized that a big part of digital culture and the culture of cyberspace were games. And so I first started teaching a game called Myst, a classic game that was a very mysterious and beautiful platform. And that was in the late 1990s.
Awesome. I have actually played Myst among some of the only few games that I have played, and I was fascinated by how intuitive it is. How did you use Myst? Because it is such an intuitive game, and there are no instructions except what you discover, and you have to try to click on things to actually discover.
That's right. Well, one of the ways I used Myst was that I had my 11-year-old son help me navigate it because I was new to gaming in the 1990s. And it was a great sort of personal experience because I had a group of non-gamers, English majors at Vanderbilt, all of whom were raising their eyebrow about, what does gaming have to do with literature? And so we they were just as bad at MIST as I was. And I had a great seminar one day when my 11-year-old came in and went around from laptop to laptop helping the undergraduates navigate through MIST. It was such a delight. But, of course, we quickly got to very interesting questions about how does the medium of a game change our experience of narrative? How does discovering something for yourself, working your way through the mystery in a very interactive way, influence questions about story and character, point of view and setting, and even the nature of time? That eventually became one of the major themes of my investigations with games in the classroom, is what is the narrative time of a game that you have to play at your own pace?
So what do you mean by that? What do you mean by the narrative time of the game?
So think about a novel. The novel has a time scheme. You're reading. The characters are moving through life at a certain pace. And language of a written narrative is able to do all kinds of things with time. You can skip 10 years in a single sentence. You can zoom in and spin a massive 800-page book like Joyce's Ulysses, focusing on one day. So narrative is written narrative is enormously flexible in the way it can represent time and the passage of time. Movies have a much harder task. They have approximately 2 hours, and if they want to have time pass, they have fewer ways to handle that than language.
Right.
Gaming adds all kinds of additional dimensions. You might have the story time of the character whose story you're uncovering, but you also might have months of playtime of your own, so that there's layers of handling of time that just aren't present in some other media.
That's a great point. Just thinking about MIST, I'm reminded of the way it was set up was multiple worlds, and you move between worlds, and it's not just physical spaces that you're moving, but also time that you're moving through. Yeah, that reminds me. That's fascinating. So from there, how did we come to online games? Obviously, the gaming itself has evolved, and you have multiplayer online games now. But tell us
about
that.
So around about 2000, we began collaborating with the head of IT, a great man here at Vanderbilt named Matt Hall, and he and I started co-teaching a course on online gaming. And we chose The Lord of the Rings Online as our game. At this time, there were several online multiplayer, massive multiplayer games like EverQuest and World of Warcraft. But we chose Lord of the Rings Online because it enabled me, as an English teacher, to talk about the differences that a book, a movie, and a game made in how the narrative was experienced. Because, of course, Lord of the Rings has a great novel, a great movie, and it's a really great online game. It's now over 10 years old, and my characters have been in that world, that persistent world, for 10 years now.
What do you think the gaming helps you? I mean, I'm thinking like the technology and how a lot of your students may not be gamers, and how are you able to get them to do this, and what are some of the benefits that they get out of doing this work in these, I mean, the remediation, having these three different media for talking about the same themes is definitely a very informative and very, it gives a lot of different perspectives. But my question is, what do the non-gamers get out of doing this?
That's right. Well, first of all, the comparative method of juxtaposing different media allows you to see things in each medium that you might not have seen otherwise. It enables you to see new features of a novel because mm-hmm. suddenly you realize that these things that you've always taken for granted always processed almost automatically because you've had many years of reading novels are had to be developed and had to be developed as techniques and conventions in prose and that they don't necessarily transfer exactly mm-hmm. to film or to gaming. So it really, by defamiliarizing things you've always taken for granted, mm-hmm. comparing media can really help students focus in on those aspects of a narrative. In the classroom, it becomes a really interesting challenge for how to get non-gamers to have this experience. So I have developed a couple of techniques for helping students play games in the classroom. First of all, I almost always get them to pair up so that two students will play the game together in case one student is not very good at it, mm-hmm. doesn't have the kind of manual dexterity, for the two of you to sit there together. And it's not always an experienced gamer with a neophyte, mm-hmm. but you're sharing the experience of kind of struggling through the game.
Right.
The other thing is you can't complete a game in a single assignment or for preparation for a seminar the next day. Mm-hmm. So I say things like, play it a minimum of 2 hours. Just so you get the experience, and mm-hmm. then we'll come in and talk it through, and some will have gotten further than you, some perhaps not as far. A third way that I handle this difficulty is I gamify gameplay. Have you heard about the movement of gamification, which is to turn activities that aren't usually games mm-hmm. into games? So I almost always have a contest going for which team gets the furthest in the game. And I usually have a little prize. It's a surprise. And so that seems to be really fun for the students. They get into that. So some, we just played Braid in mm-hmm. my seminar this semester. Braid is a really difficult experimental game. It's an indie game, an independent game, that both relies on a platforming or side-scrolling mm-hmm. game mechanic, which you're familiar with from a multitude of games like Donkey Kong, for example. Mm-hmm. It relies on that mechanics, but it is a kind of meta game. It's continually posing questions about the form of the game, and it has its theme happens to be the passage of time, and so many of the levels allow you to reverse time. It's also incredibly hard, just mechanically mm-hmm. hard. So beginners have trouble getting through any but the first two or three levels.
Wow.
So two different teams just became obsessed with it. Two out of the, five teams I had played essentially all weekend long. You know, it's like 72 hours of gaming.
Is there a better class on campus? Hey, this is so much fun, it sounds to me.
Well, it's a lot of fun. And I'll tell you, it's a lot of fun to teach, not just because it's fun material mm-hmm. And intellectually challenging material, but also because it attracts a really diverse classroom. I have a wonderful mixture of English majors, other humanities students, mm-hmm. but also computer science students, gamer engineering students, gamers and people who are interested in gaming come from all over campus.
Right.
And so they're talking to one another in settings that that they don't always experience. Mm-hmm. You know, English majors see a lot of other English majors.
That's such a wide range of expertise and perspectives. Oh, this is awesome. How have you been keeping up with the changes in the gaming field? You just talked about a game that has been very challenging. And do you also avidly, do you play games and do you keep up with the new and the fun stuff that's out there?
So I continue to play different games. However, I'm an English professor with an active research
yes.
life and director of a center, so I don't have time to play a ton of games.
Right.
So what I do is I read the reviews of games and try to see which new games will present something different mm-hmm. to me and to my class intellectually. So this semester, we're going to be playing Journey, Braid, Gone Home, and Lord of the Rings Online, and a new-to-me dystopian game called Papers, Please, which models a problem of immigration in a dystopian society.
Right.
These are all renowned games from different genres of mm-hmm. gaming. You know, I don't tend to play first-person shooters. I have played them. I don't tend to jump on the latest mm-hmm. game unless I've read things that make me think that it will present a new facet of the gaming experience mm-hmm. or a new way to think about narrative in relation to gaming.
Right. When you use these games, you have to think about how what benefit it brings to the students, and you have to help them get into the games and play these things. So this independent versus multiplayer online games, how do they make those bridges? I mean, like, because it's one thing to do, like, you know, where you are sitting by yourself or with another partner at a computer and playing the games versus going online where you're suddenly thrown into an arena where there's, like, people from all over the world who are playing, and especially with the Lord of the Rings Online. I come from this from your MOOC, where you have had games, these online platforms having a curator or a person who's helping them guide your students.
Well, the students are playing Lord of the Rings Online right now, and that's kind of a persistent thread through the first half of the class. They play it for several months, but they don't have to play it really intensively. But I want them to see exactly what you've described, that a persistent world, massive online game has a community that brings you into relationships with people all over the world, and it allows us to talk about some of the social aspects of gaming, mm-hmm. some of the ways in which it's online gaming at least, creates an intermediate experience between the virtual and the face-to-face.
Mm-hmm.
You have deep relationships with people, some of whom I've known now for 10 years. I'm the guild leader of the oldest and one of the largest guilds on our server in Lord of the Rings Online. Mm-hmm. And so we've had members of our guild, Lord of the Rings calls it kinship, so I'll start calling it kinship. We've had some die, we've had some go to war in military service, have children. I've sometimes met them in person. It's a really different relationship to sociality from anything that you've one has experienced before. Mm-hmm. And it's not simply this opposition between the real world and this virtual world. Mm-hmm. It's something in between. And so that's a very interesting experience. But it also provides students with a very interesting relationship to narrative, because The Lord of the Rings Online has its own narrative that is different from Tolkien's work. It's set
interesting.
Well, it's set totally in Middle Earth. It's mm-hmm. set in Tolkien's world, but you have a role which is defending the rear guard mm-hmm. of the Fellowship. So the Fellowship has gone off on the story that right. Tolkien's telling, mm-hmm. and you have your own story and your own role in that world. And from time to time, if you progress far enough, you'll cross paths with
that must be rewarding,
Fellowship.
Right? Yes.
Oh, but it's a big reward. You know, you said rewarding, but because games always use a reward structure mm-hmm. and a leveling up structure, meeting one of the members of the Fellowship at a certain place on their journey is a reward for your achievement inside the game.
Right, yes. So you, as a person in these games, are creating your own character, and the way you're engaging with the game is also educational, because you're learning about the settings, the people, the social life, mm-hmm. everything, mm-hmm. and about Middle Earth and Tolkien's world also.
That's right.
But what about those characters, the original characters that Tolkien created, the Fellowship, and mm-hmm. the hobbits and everybody else in the storyline itself? Are they real somebody who's role playing,
no.
or are they created as part of the?
Yeah. So they're called NPCs, non-player characters.
Okay.
They're not real people, and in fact, you're not allowed to take the name of any character in Tolkien.
So I could never be Frodo.
You can never be Frodo. So that's a choice on their part.
Right. Okay. That makes sense. Like, your students are creating their character within the game, the online game that they are playing. Do you have a similar exercise where they do something where they actually either create a game as part of the classwork or create characters and bring it together as part of the work you do?
So the current incarnation of this class is new media.
Okay.
So the class is not solely devoted to gaming. Gaming is one example of new media. So all the written assignments, as opposed to the reading assignments, reading or viewing mm-hmm. or playing assignments, involve creating new media works of their own. So I kind of scaffold those assignments. You know, the very first is to take a screenshot of your character. You know, what could be easier? Mm-hmm. It's so easy that we do it sort of the first day of class. But, you know, take a screenshot and then do some screen capture while you play the game.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have the students create a video essay. It's an essay where they do a voiceover commentary mm-hmm. on a activity in the game. But the voiceover commentary is not a playthrough. They're not talking about, oh, here's how you do it.
Okay.
It's rather, what am I seeing about narrative or point of view or setting? Oh. And illustrating their voice commentary with a montage of various scenes from the game.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the first major project. The course culminates in the students creating a game of their own. Again, I use the teamwork method
okay.
because most of the people in the class are not adept with writing computer code.
Mm-hmm.
But generally, three or four of are. And
right.
so we have teams, usually three-person teams. I try to sort them into someone with some graphic arts skills, someone with some writing skills, and someone with some coding skills. And then I introduce them to a number of free programs for game making.
Okay.
And they can range from very simple sketch games to more complex game making platforms all the way up to Unity.
Right. I was going to ask about Unity. Mm-hmm. Okay. So you don't.
And this semester I have a student who I taught last semester in a university course on virtual reality.
Right.
A course co-taught by Ole Mulvig and Bobby Bodenheimer in history mm-hmm. and physics, no, history and computer science, respectively. This student made a virtual reality environment based on the novel Ready Player One as part of a team for the virtual reality course last semester.
Okay.
She's now in my new media class, and she's very eager to continue to build out that virtual reality environment.
That's awesome.
It is going to be so much fun. And she is going to be joined by two other students. And we will, of course, go over to the Wondery and have the whole class experience the virtual reality mm-hmm. that she's already created. We're reading the novel Ready Player One. And as you probably know, Steven Spielberg has made a movie of it that's coming out later this semester. So we're having a class field trip to the premiere of the movie of Ready Player One.
Fabulous.
So the team that will be continuing to construct this virtual reality environment will have read the novel, have seen the movie, and now will be continuing work mm-hmm. On this room that she began last semester. The room as it exists is H's playroom or clubhouse.
Okay.
And the team last semester managed to create the whole room and populate it with some terrific 1980s posters and furniture and made it really a wonderful environment that captures mm-hmm. this important scene from the novel. This semester, they need to turn it into a game. You notice I've been calling it a virtual reality environment.
Right.
Now I want it to be a VR game.
Right.
And so we'll develop a storyline inside the room that can only be unlocked by clicking on the right combination of objects, finding hidden keys, mm-hmm. pulling out drawers to find parts of a message. So there'll be a creation of an independent new narrative to play through once we gamify the environment.
This is almost bringing it back to the virtual environment.
Well, of course, yes. Myst was a really influential game, and it also links up with Gone Home. Gone Home is a indie game about a young woman who comes back from a year away to her home mm-hmm. and finds everyone gone. And it's kind of a mystery as to what has happened.
Right.
And it involves, I don't want to give any spoilers for what has happened, but it's a really complex narrative that she has to uncover from clues.
Mm-hmm.
And for her to uncover those clues, the player has to solve mystery after mystery.
Right.
And that is a more elaborate narrative than Myst, but it's the same set of game mechanics.
Mm-hmm.
It also is a much more socially and culturally rich narrative. The narrative takes place in a contemporary environment and involves contemporary problems of a marriage and of a family mm-hmm. and of love relationships. And that's very different from Myst, which is
very abstract and
a fantasy world.
Yeah.
It's a fantasy science fiction world set on other planets
exactly.
and has a final act that is I can't reveal it without spoiling this.
Don't give away any spoilers. What I love about what you're doing is you don't allow your students to get lost in the game, because the game itself is like a full-time engagement. You can keep playing it.
Yes.
But you're bringing them back to the narrative, and you're keeping that tension going with, this world, the narrative, and the gaming world, which is, you have to bring the links back. Was that a challenge when you did your online course?
You mean the Coursera class?
The Coursera class, yeah.
I don't think that was a challenge in terms of the content of the course. What was a challenge was that now 95,000 people have taken this course, mm-hmm. from 123 different countries, many of whom, many of the students were non-native English speakers.
That's right, yeah.
And so I'd say the biggest challenge was teaching a college-level course with Vanderbilt-level ideas, mm-hmm. and content. To a population of every possible age range and every possible nationality.
Right.
So the cultural references that I could use in my lectures had to be very carefully chosen. The language that I used, I tended to speak very slowly and carefully, mm-hmm. and I heavily edited every one of those videos to try and achieve that. And that was a great challenge. It was my first experience of teaching online.
Mm-hmm. But it came out to be a wonderful class.
Oh, well, thank you. You know, it's really easy to bring out the narrative content of these games, mm-hmm. and to teach important concepts about literature and storytelling, mm-hmm. via gaming. Today, in this morning's class, we talked about the difference between realism and romance. And we'd been building toward that for several class periods as we looked at Lord of the Rings, mm-hmm. as a romance novel and a romance game,
right.
and contrasted that with realistic characters. You know, we contrasted the hero versus villain, the mm-hmm. good versus evil in
right.
a romance versus more complex interior characters in a realistic novel.
Mm-hmm.
So it was able to bring out things that students, of course, understood about the novel, but mm-hmm. perhaps never thought of them.
Yeah. Right, yes.
And that's part of what education is.
This is great. Thank you so much, Jay. And before we finish up this wonderful conversation, I can keep on asking you about gaming and the different games you've used and so on. But my quick question for you is, what analog technology do you like?
I'm trying to think of what analog technology I don't like.
Okay.
So I have been an avid television watcher since childhood. Television is now digital, not analog, mm-hmm. but once upon a time it was really quite analog.
Yes.
I like radio. We go to the symphony and the opera. We're subscribers to both here, mm-hmm. in Nashville. I go to the Country Music Hall of Fame and listen to blues and bluegrass and rock music. It's very hard for me to think of an art form, whether analog or digital, that I don't have a passion for.
Thank you, Jay.
Thank you.
Gayatri, that was a really fun interview.
Thank you.
I'm always impressed at all the different aspects of culture that Jay Clayton appreciates, from opera to video games and everything in between.
So, Derek, you've listened to the interview now, and Jay's class sounds really fun. And why do you think it works so well?
That's a good question. And I think it does sound like a lot of fun. And I think Jay makes some moves as an instructor, actually, that are really effective. He talked about a couple of them. So, for instance, when he has his students play a new video game in pairs. He talked about how that's helpful because if one of them kind of gets it a little faster than the other, they can kind of help each other out. Mm-hmm. But I think there's another layer there, actually. As students are encountering this new video game, this new text, so to speak, they have someone to talk with about what they're seeing and what they're encountering. And given what we know about active and collaborative learning, mm-hmm. That's probably a much better environment to encounter this piece of new media than if students were just kind of on their own doing it, right? Having to decide, like, what to do in the game and uh-huh. what steps to take, they're having to talk that out as a pair, and that helps them start that first layer of kind of analyzing what's happening mm-hmm. and putting words to their own experience in the game. So that collaborative work, I think, is really interesting.
Making it explicit, right?
Yes, exactly. It's kind of like a think aloud, actually. Mm-hmm. Like, they have to kind of articulate out loud what they're encountering, right. what they're doing, what they're thinking in the game. So there's moves like that that I think are good. And then, you know, in the podcast, we've talked about this idea of engaging students as producers of knowledge mm-hmm. and not just consumers of information. And so that final project that he described where students are actually making video games, it's a really interesting pedagogical move because I think his goal is to help them become more kind of critical consumers, uh-huh. right? To be able to apply a critical and analytical lens to video games and other new media. Mm-hmm. One way to help students do that is to give them an experience producing those media themselves.
Right.
And there's this kind of interesting interplay between the kind of critical lens and the creative lens mm-hmm. that Jay's tapping into with that final project. So this is really interesting from a teaching and learning perspective.
It reminds me of your panel on using podcasts in the classroom, too.
Yeah, absolutely.
So did you hear things that Jay said that he's using in his class that might be applicable to other classes on campus or elsewhere?
I was thinking about that because, you know, there's only so many people who are going to be teaching game studies courses, right? But the fact that, you know, some of the strategies he's using to help his students explore this new media could work in other courses that look at other media or other types of objects or texts. So, for instance, I was really struck by his strategy of having students play a video game for a certain number of hours, mm-hmm. but not necessarily finish it. And I was a little reminded of this giant novel I assigned in one of my courses, Cryptonomicon, which was way too big and no one finished it, including me. It was a real mistake on my part. But I could have had my students read a portion of it, right? Or read it for 5 hours and see mm-hmm. what they come up with. But I'm also thinking of other things where, like, if you want students to explore some social network they're not familiar with, or maybe an online digital humanities database of some sort, mm-hmm. you could, instead of saying, these are things that don't have starts and finishes, right? Like video games often. And so giving them a time limit to say, I want you to spend 2 hours exploring this resource and then come back with your observations and, mm-hmm. and findings. I think that's an interesting move. I think also the other assignment that caught my ear was the video with voiceover commentary. So students will play a game and they'll screen capture their experience playing it and mm-hmm. then they'll edit that into a video where they add their commentary. And it's not so much the kind of playthrough commentary. It's different than the think alouds that they uh-huh. might be doing as they're playing it, but it's the kind of analytical, critical lens that they're bringing to it. And I can easily see other faculty using a tool like that. Mm-hmm. I actually talked with a faculty member recently at Indiana University, Bloomington, Ashley Hastie. She's in a very different field, merchandising. Uh-huh. And she teaches a course on window displays. Right, so she has a bunch of designers who are mm-hmm. creating window displays for businesses, you know, stores, things like that. Well, she has her students take a photograph of what they've created, and they use this tool called VoiceThread to kind of add in their own audio mm-hmm. commentary to that photo.
Right.
And so this idea of having students create something or put something together and then add their own kind of commentary track to it, I mm-hmm. think, is a really interesting way to get at some of the student learning that may not always be visible in kind of the work that they do,
right.
To get at kind of how they're thinking about the work that they're doing.
Mm-hmm. That's really cool. It's also innovative uses of technology. We've used VoiceThread before a few years ago in showing how this can be done, where we can take a picture and add annotated comments to it. And it's fascinating to hear people using it in different contexts.
Well, thank you for sharing this interview, Gayatri. It was really interesting.
Thank you.
And I know I got a few interesting ideas for courses I might teach. So we're going to have some links to Jay Clayton and some of his work in our show notes. You can find those show notes as well as past and future episodes of Leading Lines on our website, leadinglinespod.com. You can follow us on Twitter at leadinglinespod, and you can send us a voice memo with your thoughts on this episode at our email address, leadinglinespod@vanderbilt.edu. We'd love to hear from you. Oh, I almost forgot. We have a new Facebook group for the podcast. So you're welcome to find us on Facebook, Leading Lines Podcast there. Follow us that way. If you do, please share. We're trying to grow that community now as well. Leading Lines is produced by the Center for Teaching at Vanderbilt University, also the Vanderbilt Institute for Digital Learning, the Office of Scholarly Communications at the Vanderbilt Library, and the Associate Provost for Digital Learning. This episode was edited by Rhett McDaniel. Look for new episodes the first and third Monday of each month. I'm your host, Derek Bruff. Thanks for listening.